Michael Ponser graduated from Harvard College and Yale Law School in 1994. President Bill Clinton appointed him a life-tenured U.S. District Judge. He continues to serve as a senior U.S. District Judge in the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts, Western Division. He's written a new novel. It is entitled The Hanging Judge. It is his first novel, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. How nice.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you think generally most judges have a novel in them?
Many do. At least many talk about it. I've had a number of people come up to me since this book came out and begin to chat about their thoughts or fantasies about sometimes writing a novel. And so I think it's on people's minds. It doesn't happen all that often. The novels may be in there, but they very rarely come out.
What led you to want to write it? At some point during your career, did you say, okay, this is what I would like to write about?
Yes. I had been playing around with fiction for most of my adult life and trying to write a novel. Wrote an entire novel once. Got a short story published when I was in law school. But what really triggered it for me was the experience of presiding over a death penalty case. I felt that I'd had a trip down a road that other people might want to know about. And so I designed a novel built around the plot of a judge, somewhat similar to me, who is facing the responsibility of presiding over a procedure that was going to decide whether someone should live or die.
It seems, certainly in the novel, and it seems just in that answer, that it is that idea of a capital case that drew you in, that idea of life and death.
Yeah. The intensity of that experience, I think, broke something open inside me and gave me a sort of focus and intensity to actually sit down and begin to write it. I wanted to take the reader and bring the reader up on the bench with me. And say, okay, sit here next to me, and we'll try this case together. And that's what I tried to do in the novel.
We so often see it from the perspective of a prosecutor, or of the defense, or even of a jury.
Mm-hmm.
But to see it from a judge's perspective, that is rarer. Which first part of the question is, why do you believe that is? Mm-hmm. And the second part of the question is, what do you think we miss from not getting that perspective?
It is rare, as you say. And I was talking to someone about that. And what they basically said was they thought it was rare for the story to be told from the judge's perspective because it's so boring. The judges in movies and television and so on, there's some woman or some man sitting up there saying denied or sustained or overruled. And they are usually very passive and not terribly interesting. And so I think there's this kind of assumption that the judge is up there just as a sort of neutral character without much in the way of interest. That's not true. In fact, if you're a judge, it's an extraordinarily vivid experience sitting up on the bench. And I felt that people would be missing out on a sort of perspective from someone who's really objective about the process. I don't take the position of the defense. I don't take the position of the prosecutor. I'm looking at the whole process, and I have a kind of breadth of vision over the whole landscape that I think people might find interesting.
Okay, now for the loaded question. Ready? Do you think the process works?
Yes, I think it works remarkably well, considering the stresses that are placed upon it. Our legal system, even the notion of a legal system, is so precious and unusual and by no means inevitable that I think we sometimes ignore it or overlook just how unique it is. It's like the water we swim in. They say fish don't notice the water. But in the world today, and in human history, it's mostly the strong who tell everybody else what to do. And if they don't do it, you either get hit over the head or chased in the woods. The notion that there's an arena that tries, not always successfully, but tries, usually successfully, to be fair to both sides and to listen and to make a decision based not upon someone's affiliations strengths or situation within the power system, but based on rules agreed to ahead of time is unbelievably amazing, a great act of human imagination. And our legal system does work most of the time, but it is fallible. It is a human creation. And the book tries to bring out the ways in which the stresses push human weakness to the surface.
In the book, we meet David Norcross, who is a federal judge like yourself. And mm-hmm. where do you believe, how similar did you want his experience to be to yours?
I wanted the context to be similar. And so David Norcross, my fictional judge, sits in Springfield, Massachusetts, where I sit. I thought of changing the name of the city to Gotham City or Elmberg or some, transparently invented city name. I thought everybody's going to know what I'm talking about anyway. Let's just call it Springfield. So the context is the same as mine. He's quite different from me. Several people have told me that they think he's nicer than I am. I think he probably is. He's a little greener than I am. He's only been on the bench a couple of years. He makes a couple of rookie mistakes during the course of the book. So he's different from me. I had a colleague who's a good friend of mine who said, "Michael, we all know that David Norcross is really you." And I said, that's not true. Norcross comes from Wisconsin. I come from Minnesota. They're totally, totally different. So there is some similarity between me and Judge Norcross.
So getting back to what we were talking about just before that question, which is this idea of us putting us in that seat next to you, putting us next to David, the pressure that you feel, again, I think this perspective is often lost. The pressure that you feel, especially in a capital case, of what that is like, is that with you every moment of that trial?
Absolutely. It bears down on you quite heavily. And I think most people could probably project themselves into this position. Imagine that you were there and you're in a room a little bigger than most rooms, maybe half the size of a typical gymnasium. And you're looking at a group of ordinary people called in off the street, and you're saying to them, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be going through a process by which we're going to decide whether that person," and you can point to them only 20 feet away, a living, breathing person, "should be deliberately killed. And it will be my job to make sure that the process of making that decision is fair and comports with the rules." Well, every time I say that, and every time I said it in the courtroom, there was a silence that fell over the courtroom. And the air was like cellophane. You could practically poke it with your finger. The tension was so profound. And people feel that, and the judge feels that. And it really doesn't lift throughout the course of the trial, and it stays with you for a while afterwards and leading up to it.
There are so many facets to this. There's the community, there is the prosecutor, there is the defense, there is, of course, the accused, there is the victim or the victim's family, there is the media.
Yes.
And you write about the media pressure, and that's a large part of this, because you don't want it to become a circus, and yet, almost by its very design, it is, isn't it?
Right. There's one scene in the courtroom where David Norcross is sitting there, and he's aware that he's overlooked something. His courtroom deputy has given him a glance, which is a warning glance. "You've overlooked some part of the procedure," and he's trying very hard to figure out what that is. And then he glances over at the reporters. And in my trial, the reporters and sketch artists had a couple of rows in the front that we set aside for them. And I said, "They're not bad people, these journalists, but they look like buzzards sitting there waiting for a gory catastrophe." And they are professionals. And then he said, "But if I make a mistake, they will grind my bones to make their bread." And that's how you feel a little bit up there. Their job is to report it. And if you let the ball hit you in the middle of the forehead and bounce into the dugout, there's going to be a front page photograph of the expression on your face as that happens. I'm speaking figuratively, of course, but that's a pressure that you're aware of.
What do you think we can learn from your book, a fictional book, a novel, that mm-hmm. that we wouldn't get if you were to write your story, the Michael Ponser story?
I hope that the narrative conveys a more complete sense of the reality of the process than a strictly non-fictional report might. For one thing, in the book, I'm freed to tell the story from a number of different perspectives. So there's a kind of triangulation that goes on. So I tell the story primarily from the perspective of the judge, but also from the perspective of the defense attorney, the prosecuting attorney, who's a Latina named Lydia Gomez Larson, from the point of view of the arresting cop, the two law clerks, the family of the victim, the wife of the defendant. So I'm hoping that that the narrative will carry enough force and will be presented from enough different perspectives that it will give the reader a real sense of how the whole process works. And I don't think I could do that. I know I couldn't do that writing just a strictly nonfiction piece.
Why do you think we are fascinated with law and justice? Mm-hmm. It is a staple in the bookstore. It's a staple on television and in film. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about justice mm-hmm. and crime that we as a people find fascinating?
I don't know, but I can speculate. Here's one way of looking at it. We depend upon a certain amount of external constraint to allow us to live together as a community. I have friends, smart friends, who are anarchists, not people who throw bombs and look weird, but people who really think that government causes more harm than good. I don't believe that. I look at the Eastern Congo. I look at areas where that are torn apart, where things fall apart. We do need a structure, and law, at its best, I believe, is a nurturing force. It creates a shelter in which we can feel safe enough to be with the people we love and pursue the things that we want to pursue as individuals. So we need a shelter of the law, but we also resent it. We also resent being constrained, and we want to free to do what we want. I mean, I just drove here down the Mass Pike, and I'm looking over my shoulder. I'm a judge. And I see a state trooper, and I go, whoops, and I slow down, just like everybody else. And so we need a shelter. We can't really cope with anarchy and chaos and the survival of the fittest. And at the same time, the structure is something that confines us and that we resent. And also, it can be very arbitrary. It can be grossly unjust and unfair at times. So the book is really a celebration of that. It's explicitly patriotic. The book begins with red, white, and blue balloons and ends with red, white, and blue balloons. Those two images were deliberate. It's a kind of bunting around the book as a gesture towards a sort of patriotic tribute to the legal system. But the book also is, I hope, frank and honest about the fact that what we try to do is fallible and rough justice a lot of the time.
Michael Ponser's new novel is The Hanging Judge. It is published by Open Road. What a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
Certainly my pleasure, too. Thank you very
great
much.
Great pleasure. Again, the new book is The Hanging Judge, published by Open Road. Michael Ponser is our guest. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.